Chapter 23 Determined Reporters. The truth in regard to your leader heals the sick and saves the sinner. Mary Baker Eddy, 1905. The Daily Mail at Pleasant View kept several secretaries busy, their first task each day, beginning to decide what needed Mrs. Eddy's attention. The correspondence from her churches and students all over the world had to be sifted, while the constant stream of missives from her lieutenants in Boston, directors, trustees, and editor, always had priority. There was a good deal of correspondence early in 1905 regarding changes in the journal. The April issue would begin Volume 23. With a new dress. In February, Mr. Johnson had written from Pleasant View to Mr. Mackenzie that Mrs. Eddy would send a list of contributors and some suggestions before publication of the April number. Also, that she was returning their samples, having marked her preference, but would like a lighter shade of green for the cover. A little later, she approved the color and lettering, but did not care for the faddish edges, stating, quote, "The shabby, uneven top, bottom, and sides I do not like," end quote. On April 2nd, she wrote Mr. McClellan that this month's journal was fine, the only imperfection being too many testimonies, quote, 24 pages, are too much like patent medicine suggestions, end quote. This April 2nd letter also stated, "Please present my compliments to the Publishing Society for their loving sense of my little poem, and for $100, which I certainly do not desire for the service rendered, but greatly prize the courtesy that prompted it. You must not repeat it, but give me the pleasure to know what you think of my old age versification." This was no doubt for, quote, "Wither," end quote, Miscellany, page 350, which was the leader in the April journal. But it is not likely that her ambitious young editor felt the poem's depth and meaning. Today it continues to lift the, quote, "weight of anguish," end quote, from her disciples, who feel overburdened by, quote, "the Stygian shadow of a world of glee," end quote, as it surely lifted the leader above the shafts of the mental assassins to love divine in the spring of 1905. On April 26th, she wrote to Calvin Hill, "The first thing I do in the morning when I awake is to declare I shall have no other mind before divine mind, and become conscious of this, and then adhere to it throughout the entire day, and then the evil cannot touch me. I have done it, but am a poor specimen of preservation. But the greatest miracle of the age is that I am alive." An appreciative letter from Mrs. Mims, commenting upon Mrs. Eddy's article on divorce, caused the leader to write her editor in April to please publish Mrs. Mims' letter along with these comments. On reading the above letter from our distinguished lecturer and beloved student, I was reminded of the following scripture, quote, "For as Jonas was a sign unto the Ninevites, so shall also the Son of Man be to this generation. The Queen of the South shall rise up in the judgment with the men of this generation and condemn them. For she came from the utmost parts of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And behold, a greater than Solomon is here." End quote. Luke 11, verses 30 and 31. The leader wrote to churches in Brooklyn, Pittsburgh, and St. Louis, Miscellany, page 196, in April, but her letter to Third Church, London, Miscellany, page 205, on April 28th, is of special interest. There had been an epidemic of letters from students of science at this time, all of which had been withheld from Mrs. Eddy by her secretaries. Several referred to a distinguishable portrait of Mrs. Eddy in the shadows on the full moon, asking if this had spiritual significance. One from Providence told of a practitioner's taking a group of students to a reading room to view a portrait of Jesus, which in a certain light resembled Mrs. Eddy. Mr. Carpenter knew that these and similar letters relating to such phenomena, many of which had come from England, had not been seen by Mrs. Eddy. Yet, when she dictated the letter to Third Church, London, to Gilbert Carpenter, one short paragraph stated, "Seeing a man in the moon, or seeing a person in the picture of Jesus, or believing that you see an individual who has passed through the shadow called death, is not seeing the spiritual idea of God, but it is seeing a human belief, which is far from the fact that portrays life, truth, love." One of the issues that her secretaries endeavored to handle without disturbing the leader was the constant stream of requests from reporters for interviews with Mrs. Eddy. They turned down all such requests and did their best to shield her from this invasion. But in the spring of 1905, one persistent reporter from the Boston Herald would not give up. Her name was Mrs. Sybil Wilbur O'Brien. Sybil Wilbur. Sybil Wilbur's mother was a Congregationalist, and her father was a Quaker, but both died before Sybil had finished school, so she left her New York home to live with Methodist relatives in the Midwest, where she attended a Methodist university in St. Paul. Her journalistic career, which began in Minneapolis with society editing, took her next to Washington, D.C., where she met and married a gay young Irishman named O'Brien and joined the Catholic Church. In her reporting, she covered all areas from working and weeping with striking minors to lunching, teaing, and dining with celebrities, all of which she termed an apprenticeship to her next step, foreign correspondence. Quote, "Embassies and spring salons in Paris, ballets, racing and parliament, teas on the embankment in London," end quote. This worldly success had been Miss Wilbur's life for 15 years. Now, at age 35, she had her own feuilleton in the Boston Herald, her own page to fill each Sunday with topics of her own choice. In less than a year in Boston, she had interviewed a great many New England dignitaries, including prominent speakers at Harvard University, the aged queen of the Back Bay, Julia Ward Howe, and a great many others. Miss Wilbur soon learned that the toast of Boston snobbishness, quote, "to the great state of Massachusetts, home of the sacred cod, where the Lowells speak only with Cabots, and the Cabots speak only with God," end quote, was growing old. But some Boston intellectuals, the wits, were extending it to a woman in Concord, New Hampshire, which caught her interest. They said this woman lived in seclusion, spoke only with God, and had learned a strange language, which none but herself and some of her followers could understand. Miss Wilbur had not been in Boston long enough to know much about Christian Science activities in that metropolis, but her interest was aroused, and she suggested to her editor the name of Mrs. Eddy of Concord for one of her Sunday topics. He laughed tolerantly as he responded, quote, "That might be interesting to some people and tiresome to more, but you won't get anywhere with it. She is a recluse, probably an invalid, or this seclusion may be a pose. Her representatives guard her like the Pope in the Vatican." End quote. And who are her representatives? Her principal spokesman is Alfred Farlow. Every time we mention the subject of Christian Science in a newsway, he appears with a correction. And he is so suave and persistent, we have to insert the correction. It's a nuisance because we never seem to say things right. End quote. After a good deal more conversation, he said of course they would print an interview with Mrs. Eddy if she should get it. Quote, "But you won't get it." End quote. Miss Wilbur's next step was to call on Alfred Farlow for a letter of introduction. She found his office in very modest quarters on Huntington Avenue, and very convenient to where she lived, just across the square. On this visit, she asked him if Christian Science did not mean mind over matter, and was astonished by his reply. Quote, "No, Miss Wilbur. Christian Science says there is no matter. That is just how ridiculous we are in the eyes of the world. Matter is a state of mortal mind. In reality, all is spirit." End quote. He smiled kindly, and they sat in silence, for as an interviewer she had learned not to argue, but she was thinking, quote, "No matter indeed, when we live and move and have our being in matter." End quote. As the conversation resumed, she felt Mr. Farlow's attitude was that of a sympathetic teacher with an intelligent child. She did not gain the letter she sought, but was invited to return whenever there was something more she wished to discuss. About this time, God moved in Miss Wilbur's life with what she described as a struggle and sharp experiences which changed the aspect of my world. After a long night of sorrow, I heard one Sunday morning the bells of the new Old South across the square, and said aloud, quote, "God, let me do something for women who are alone." End quote. As she voiced this prayer to God, a vision of the woman in Concord came before her eyes, and all doubt of the woman's noble cause dropped away from this worldly journalist. In ensuing visits with Mr. Farlow, she began learning a little about spirit and matter, but her main purpose still was an interview with Mrs. Eddy. Several visits, and about 2 months later, Mr. Farlow told her one day that Mr. Armstrong, a director of the church, was coming to see her with a message from Mrs. Eddy. When he came, he looked observingly around my study and somewhat scrutinizingly at me, I thought, and I looking at this bearded man, rugged, honest, earnest, said to myself, quote, "Here is St. Peter, I do believe. Come to my abode, greatly humble and humbly great. And what has he for me?" End quote. He had a letter from Mrs. Eddy and a copy of Science and Health, and a signed photograph. He said very little, refused to be seated, and departed, leaving a current of fresh air that came as from another world, a world much different from smug and busy Boston, Back Bay mansions, or even classic Harvard. The letter from the leader that Joseph Armstrong bore said, March 25, 1905, "Dear Madam, you will excuse me since I must be uniform in declining the honor of calls from newspaper reporters. Christian Science cannot be carried on in certain worldly ways. Accept my thanks and this book. Please read page 464, paragraph 1. Sincerely yours, Mary Baker Eddy." Miss Wilbur immediately read paragraph 1 on page 464, and this gracious refusal caused her to ponder her own motives. She determined to read Science and Health and set down all her questions and criticisms and began carrying the book, covered everywhere she went, reading on trains and streetcars. The book answered many of the first foolish questions on her list, which were crossed off as more mature questions were added. Several weeks had elapsed when Miss Wilbur arose a little late one Sunday morning, took in her morning papers, and saw screaming headlines in the New York Herald about Mrs. Eddy. The story depicted Mrs. Eddy as a hopeless invalid, unbalanced, if not insane, and her followers as duped by those who kept the leader drugged and helpless. Amazed and indignant that America's greatest newspaper would flash such an outrage to the world, she phoned Mr. Farlow, then, with his assent, dashed across Copley Square to his office. She found him unbelievably calm and composed, and asked breathlessly if he hadn't seen the morning's New York Herald. When he said he had, she said, quote, "You have seen the papers? You know what has happened?" End quote. His calm reply was, quote, "I have seen the papers. Nothing has happened." End quote. Miss Wilbur expostulated a little longer, then burst into tears, and Mr. Farlow gently told her to sit down and compose herself. I sat down, wept a little longer, dried my eyes, and looked at him. He was leaning back composedly in his chair, no longer smiling, but gazing at me seriously, questioningly. Presently he said, quote, "One might think you loved Mrs. Eddy. Do you?" Quote, "I don't know. How can I know? I am thinking of her church, her great book, her noble work for humanity. They want to make it all ridiculous, make her a foolish, silly old woman, a lunatic. This beloved Christian woman, all right-minded people must at least respect. Yes, I love her, and I want to help her." End quote. Miss Wilbur could not accept Mr. Farlow's assurance that nothing had happened to Mrs. Eddy. She said she knew that newspaper and that it would print the story in its Paris Herald in London and in Rome, would stop at nothing and would keep it up until someone outside the Christian Science Church answered them. To which Mr. Farlow responded, quote, "Perhaps you will be that someone," end quote. Then he offered to send her list of questions to Mrs. Eddy at Pleasant View. But Miss Wilbur declared emphatically that now was the time to go to Pleasant View, and she was going with or without a letter of introduction. When she told her decision to her editor, he said she would fare no better than the New York Herald reporters who had prowled the grounds and photographed Mrs. Eddy being helped into her carriage, but had not been admitted to the house. Before the week was out, however, Mr. Farlow gave her a letter of introduction to Calvin Fry, though not to Mrs. Eddy, and Saturday morning found Miss Wilbur on her way to Concord. It was afternoon when she arrived at the gate of Pleasant View, where she dismissed her carriage, and only a few minutes later, when she was in the library conversing with Mr. Fry, who was very busy and a little annoyed. At his insistence that Mrs. Eddy was very busy and would not grant an interview, she replied that she would wait in Concord until Mrs. Eddy was free to see her. "If Mrs. Eddy is ill, I will not wait. If Mrs. Eddy is not ill, I shall wait, with what patience I can find, knowing that you will eventually understand that my business is serious." After considering, Mr. Fry said that he could not persuade Mrs. Eddy, but would give her the message and hoped her decision would be favorable. Laura Sargent then showed Miss Wilbur around the lower floor, introducing her to several in the household, then introduced her to their steward, August Mann, who would show her all about the grounds. 2 or 3 hours later, after she had seen the stables and carriage house, the horses, and Mrs. Eddy's several carriages, plus the cow barn and adorable Jersey heifers, and the hothouse, Mr. Fry came down to tell Mr. Mann to send the carriage to the door to drive Miss Wilbur back to her hotel. He also bore the message that Mrs. Eddy would send her word tomorrow when she could come to see her. The next day, Sunday, May 21st, August Mann came to tell her that Mrs. Eddy would see her for a few minutes at 1 o'clock. A little before one, as she approached the door, a ripple of laughter and soft piano music greeted her ear. A few minutes later in the parlor, she again met Mrs. Sargent and a young man at the piano she had not seen the day before, Assistant Secretary Gilbert Carpenter. Mrs. Eddy had asked them, and also Mrs. Pamela Leonard, to show her the treasures in the house. To Mr. Carpenter, Miss Wilbur seemed a typical reporter, keen, intelligent, aggressive. She appeared determined not to miss anything, even turning the pictures on the wall. Before he had finished showing her the various gifts Mrs. Eddy had received, a maid came to say, "Mrs. Eddy will see you now." When she entered her study on the upper floor, Mrs. Eddy was standing looking out the window. In a moment she turned, approached, and extended her hand as she welcomed Miss Wilbur cordially, speaking her name. Then she said, quote, "All this fuss to see poor little me," end quote. Miss Wilbur answered, quote, "I feel greatly honored at the privilege granted," end quote. Quote, "But why should you, my dear child? Why do so many people wish to see me?" End quote. There were so many things Miss Wilbur had wanted to tell Mrs. Eddy, that an evil power was threatening her, etc. But she found she could not speak. In a melodiously sweet voice, Mrs. Eddy continued, quote, "All that I ask of the world now is that it grant me time to assimilate myself to God," end quote. Again, Miss Wilbur could not reply. Quote, Are you satisfied now that you have met me personally, and now that I have acceded to all your requests? End quote. To this she replied, quote, I am satisfied. End quote. A few minutes later, back in the parlor, she sat down quickly, closed her eyes, and clasped her hands over her heart. Mr. Carpenter asked if she would like to see the rooms she had not yet inspected, and she answered, quote, No, I want to go. Why didn't somebody prepare me? I didn't suppose there was any living being like that on earth. End quote. Pointing to her heart, she added, quote, It affects me right here. End quote. Many a student had felt what Sybil Wilbur experienced that day. Julia Bartlett wrote, I could not come into her presence without feeling an uplift and the love and purity of her thought. I have seen students come from her room so softened and chastened and in tears, saying they never saw such love. From the time of this meeting on May 21st, Sybil Wilbur was dedicated to defending Mrs. Eddy. At a later meeting, the leader put her hand on Miss Wilbur's shoulders and said, quote, You are doing for me what I cannot do for myself. May we gather flowers together in the fields of eternity. End quote.